Welcome to Let's Talk Land, a weekly land talk show devoted to learning about land and farms, buying and selling, ownership, especially for real estate agents and realtors. Learn from the experts, free land education. Hi, my name's Lou Jewell. I am accredited land consultant with United Country Real Estate Sutton Properties, our new company name, along with my co-host, Teresa Martin. Hey, Teresa.
Hi, Lou.
Teresa's one of our agents, and she's the student. I'm the professor, and our guest will be our expert today. Buying and selling homes, land or farms in western Piedmont, North Carolina, or southern Virginia, give us a shout. We'll help you out. Our new office is at 102 East Main Street next to BB&T in downtown Pilot Mountain, North Carolina. Please make a note of our changes. Our company website is www.allsuttonproperties.com. That's allsuttonproperties.com. Just a program note, Dr. Barbie's Ask the Doctor show will now follow this show and will air at 10 a.m. So stay tuned. Dr. Barbie's always got something of interest. Our guest today is Scott Jones. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Lou. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome. Welcome aboard. You're the you're a certified forester. You're CEO of Forest Landowners out of Atlanta, Georgia. And that's going to be our topic today is your company and you and what you do and your organization. You're a graduate with a BS in forestry from the University of Georgia, from the Daniel B. Warner School of Forestry and Natural Resources. That's a hell of a school, I hear.
Yeah, it's a great school and getting much better, so I'm glad I graduated when I did. I may not get through it this day.
I understand. Do they invite you back once in a while? Scott, come on down. Scott's been entrenched in the forestry industry for more than 25 years with a keen insight of owning and managing timberland, supply chain management, and the impact on state and federal policies. Your early career, you managed over 60,000-acre tract of timberland owned by the Smurfit Stone Container Corporation and serving as a procurement forester responsible for purchasing wood for pulp mills. You left the woods to begin your career in forestry association realm, working with the Georgian Forestry Association and Southern Lumber Manufacturing Association. What is that organization, the Southern Lumber Manufacturers?
Yeah, it's the Southeastern Lumber Manufacturers Association. It's a group of privately owned sawmills across the Southeast, stretching basically from Texas to Virginia, but they do some local and federal advocacy work on behalf of these sawmill owners. So great organization, still doing very well, providing some strong sawmill markets for these landowners.
Okay. So you gained experience in policy issues from the local, state, and federal level impacting the ownership of private forest sawmills and the entire supply chain. You've gotten some really good awards from the Georgian Registered Foresters, SAF Certified Forester, 2002, again, the Warner School of Forestry Resource Distinguished Young Alumnus. Wow, that's quite an honor. And the first recipient of the UGA Alumni Association. What's UGA?
University of Georgia.
Okay, yep, well, I should figure that one out. Teresa, you're supposed to help me on that one. with a under 40 recognition, again, from the Warner School. You live in a small farm in Bowdoin, Georgia?
Bowdoin, you got it.
And your wife is named Deborah, and you have two children. How old are your children?
They're children, 17 and 14.
Oh, so, they're not children anymore.
Quickly growing out of that category right now.
Wow, I'm sure you enjoy that. So really, you're a government affairs specialist, right? That's kind of what you do. When you get up in the morning, you think about all these issues about forestry and ownership and private ownership and you get out there in the world and support the forestry owners, right?
Yeah, and just to add a little bit, if I may, to the background of how I got into this is I've had a family land that was we got in our family since the land lotteries in the 1840s in Georgia, and I still own that piece of property that was originally deeded to our family. Of course, it was a lot larger at the time. It's been split up among family members, but we still have the original land lot, and I'm part owner of that today. And so getting into forestry and going through forestry school and managing land and buying wood, when I got into the advocacy side, when I came back to Atlanta and worked for Georgia Forestry Association and Southeastern Lumber, you know, this is a place where it's not only my education, it's not only my training, but it's my passion. I mean, this is what this land ownership has been in my family for a very long time, and it's something that I'm very passionate about. And it's just really a blessing that I'm able to express myself and my passion through my job every day, and really serve this community of landowners the best way I know how. And it's not just managing land or telling people how to manage land, but making sure that they have the right to continue managing that land, and that federal policies don't get in the way of those property rights that we enjoy as private landowners. So, yeah, when I wake up and go to work every day, this is something that I feel like I'm not only serving others, but I'm serving my family and my kids and the future generations that are going to go on to enjoy these lands that we enjoy today. So it's a real honor and privilege to be serving in this role. And I guess it's what makes work fun every day is that, you know, you get to go do this kind of work. And of course it has the grind because you have to deal with federal policymakers. But at the same time, it's a lot of fun to be in this role. So that's just a little expanded background on myself. But,
yeah, that's fine.
It's one that I'm proud of.
How many acres was the original lottery?
So the original lottery was a 288-acre track, and then it grew in size as they started farming those lands. It's in middle Georgia,
okay,
kind of between Macon and Augusta,
yeah,
for
beautiful
the
area.
Listeners who kind of know that region, kind of central Georgia, just south of I-20. And it grew over time in cotton fields, and then just like a lot of places around North Carolina and other places, you know, a lot of these ag lands either were abandoned or taken out of production, and ecological succession happens. You walk away from, you know, a hay field or an ag field, and it will grow trees,
yeah,
again.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of these lands turned into.
Sure.
And so we do have some plantations out there. But mainly that's what it became. It was just old ag lands that grew back into forest land.
Yeah, you know, if I may, I have a similar background. My mother's family acquired right around 900 acres, assembling over 18 farms between 1909 and 1929. Mom was one of 10 children, of course, as it was passed on. We're almost five generations today, and not one inch of that land has ever been sold to anyone outside the family. So,
you know, Lou, I'm glad you shared that story, because as I travel around the country and I work with a lot of landowner families, and that is a very similar story. And it's a resolve that's born into private landowners, especially these family landowners, that, you know, want to be the generation that sold the farm, right? You don't
right.
want to be that generation that said, well, we couldn't make it even though everyone else did. And so that resolve is built in, and really, I guess the key for a lot of, when I'm talking to a lot of these family landowners, that you can feel that pride, you can hear it in their voice. And what we try to do is say, how can we help make sure that they can make enough money on this property not to get rich or anything? Because if you balance it all out, I mean, most farmers and most private landowners and most land people, if you had to put all the cost against the returns they made on that property, that probably all of us would be losing
true.
Money.
Yeah.
But they make enough to where they can hang on and do the management they need and substantiate their pride on that property by saying, well, at least we're getting some return here. And that's really the key is, I mean, because especially with these family farms and these smaller tracts of land, is let's help them be economically successful so they can continue to manage those. Because, I mean, there's a lot of benefits that we all enjoy in society because of these lands exist and because they're there. We don't ever get paid for them, probably never will. But, you know, it's in society's best interest that we continue finding these ways to be successful on these properties and keep these family members, give them an excuse to keep owning these lands and keep managing them. So it's a great story, and that's probably a common thread that I hear when I talk to all these family landowners, is that resolve and pride and that sense of wanting to do things right by the land. And, you know, and it's veering off a little bit, but when you think about stewards of the land and who are the best stewards, and it's always those folks who are the owners of the land. And I heard a guy reference the one time, you know, who takes better care of their car, the guy renting it, or, you know, take a better car care of a rental car or your own car. And it's, same with land. You know, there's a sense of pride in having it.
So your organization, Forest Landowners, go back to where this type of organization got started.
So we were really founded as Forest Farmers Association in 1941 by really two visionary landowners in South Georgia. They were joined on by several other landowners from the Carolinas and over to Louisiana. But really, you go back further, and we were born out of the American Turpentine Association. That's a good place to really start the quick story of our history. The use of our forest across the South, really from colonial days all the way up until the early 1900s, was really naval stores. And we didn't have a very functioning or robust industry for fiber supply. Of course, people were sawmilling and doing things like that, but we didn't have the pulping process, which was developed by Charles Hardy around that same time, a little bit earlier than that. So there was a change going on in our forest from, really, if you saw any of the old cat faces they used to call them, where they'd scar the tree, the pine trees, and catch the resin
in
buckets. That was the turpentine industry, and boil it down really for naval store purposes. We were changing over then to help provide fiber for this growing nation. You know, we were in the middle of a war, but as we were coming out, this nation was growing again, and so there was a need to utilize the forest, not just for naval stores, but for fiber production. And so we were born by these landowners in 1941. We were originally based in Valdosta, Georgia. It was the Langdale family and the Ottmeyer family who helped found this organization. We later moved to Atlanta in the 60s, and we're still operating today. At that time, I think we were founded, we had members in three or four states. We now have members in 45 states, around 2 or 3 million acres in the organization we started. We now are pushing up on 60 million acres represented by the organization. So really have seen some tremendous growth. But the one thing we haven't changed is those visionary principles that we were founded on. And that's really to see that landowners are rewarded for, recognized for the economic and environmental contributions they make to our society. And that's what we were founded on then, ensure that we have good markets for our timber, that we have regulations that make sense, and that we have taxation that's fair and certain. If we can accomplish those three things, and they recognize this, Hotmeyers and Langdales recognized in 1941, and we still see it as the key today to success. If we can have markets for our products and have taxation that's certain and fair, and a regulatory system that's understandable, and treats landowners fairly, then we can achieve success. And that's landowners being able to pass this land down to the next generation, and that generation has an incentive, an economic incentive, to continue managing that land for the future. And that's the simple history of who we are and why we were founded, and really the principles of why we still operate today. It's an important area, and something that is being recognized across the country. We're adding members, Pacific Northwest, Northeast, here recently. But these principles that we were founded on are still very important today and still very key to achieving that success I spoke about.
Wow. Our guest today is Scott Jones. Let's talk land. Our guest is Scott Jones today, the CEO of Forest Land Association. Tell us about what you do for your members. You said you're managing over 60,000, what did you say, 60,000 was it?
Acres? 60 million acres.
60 million, sorry, I left a zero off. You know, people say million, trillion, billion, it's, it gets all crazy.
Numbers get lost somewhere.
Yeah, really. But give us kind of a profile of who your membership is. You're in the 45 states. Why they join the organization, what you do for them, what their expectations are of your organization. Kind of take us there, if you would.
Yeah, and I'll back up just for a second to who private forest landowners are in the U.S. And that's something that as I travel around and I talk to people about who I am and what I do, it always seems that there's an aha moment when you say, you know, private landowners own 58% of our nation's forest.
Right.
And you think about that, it equates somewhere around 476 million acres. And so more than the federal government and state governments and Park Service and all those combined, private forest landowners own the majority of land. And with all that land, and of course, a lot of it, when you look at a map of the U.S. and just think of the U.S. in your mind, and you think about from Maine, say, all the way down the Atlantic coast and all the way over to the Mississippi, even up into in East Texas and up to Minnesota, imagine all that just being green. That's pretty much all forest land on the East Coast, and that's a majority of our forest land in the U.S., and almost all of that is private. The vast majority is private. Like, you go to states in the South, most states in the Southeast, 85% or more is owned by private landowners. Now, you go further out west, and, of course, you get a different story because it's a lot of public ownership out there, right?
Right.
We don't take off and go to the national parks in Mississippi. You know, we go to the national parks in Montana and Wyoming. And so a lot of bigger public ownerships, a lot of big national forest out in the Pacific Northwest. And so private ownership is still out there, but not nearly as prevalent, more in the 20 to 30% range of forest ownership.
Just a question: Is the Native Americans part of that?
You know, that's considered the tribal nations,
yeah.
and that's part of kind of federal lands.
Okay.
I put them in that federal land.
That's fine. I just want to clarify
category.
That. No problem.
So no, not in the private lands.
Okay.
Good question, though, Liv.
Yeah, go ahead.
But when you look at it from the importance of those private landowners, so 58% of all of our nation's forests are privately owned. But when you think about where the wood products come from, the 2x4s that, you know, we use on our homes, the deck boards, the cabinetry, the paper products that make our lives more comfortable and show up on our doorstep when we order stuff from Amazon, that's all coming from private landowners. The federal government, our national forest, very little wood production off of there. And it's because it's for public good and supposed to be for multiple use. Do not cut a lot of national forest, and representing private landowners, that's not such a bad thing in my mind because that's a competition. But that's where the wood is coming from. It's from these private landowners. And I'm going to throw out a few quick numbers, and I know it's hard to think about these numbers on the radio, but private landowners provide more than 2.4 million jobs annually in the U.S., these private forests. They have a payroll around $87 billion a year. They produce $233 billion in annual sales. And they account for almost 6% of all U.S. manufacturing just from these private forest lands. So really, really important to our economy, really important to rural America, rural economies across the South and across the country, and also really important to our environment. I mean, there was some statistic at one time about every raindrop that fell in the U.S., a certain amount fell on private lands. When you think back to that map I was having you think about in your mind, that's a lot. I mean, you think about where water flows and where we go and recreate and where we hunt wildlife and where we go to look at birds and what cleans our air. I mean, that's coming from these forest lands. So, yeah, very, very important to our economy, very important to our environment. So our members are representative of these private landowners. That's who they are. That's who we represent. The work we do, whether they're members or not, all these landowners are going to be impacted or hopefully positively by the work that we do. So our members, like a typical profile of our member, is that family forest landowner, typically somewhere in third to fifth generation. We do have brand new landowners that are first generation in our membership, but most of them typically have fairly sizable land holdings, and that's not by design. It's because of the work we do, because we work at the federal level with Congress and the administration to make sure that landowners have the right to continue managing these lands and can be economically successful. And so typically when you're thinking about those issues, it's because you're paying a lot of taxes, because you're making money off your land every year. And that's when you start thinking about how policy can impact your property. And that's how people usually find us. So, yeah, we're bumping up over 55 million acres of forest land in the organization, almost 60 now. And members in 45 states. But like I just talked about on that map we were thinking about, the majority of our members are in the southeastern U.S. and on the East Coast. We do have members out on the West Coast, of course, because we're in 45 states. But the bulk of our membership, the real core of our membership is in the southeast, because that's where private forest lands are located in the U.S.
Right.
So really not by design or that we just don't go out west much, but that's where the private lands are located. That's who our members are and who we represent. So it's a unique constituency, but I hope, as I described, you'd see it's a very important constituency as well.
Why would I want to recommend to my family? I don't own any of the land. Mother inherited 100 acres and sold it to one of her brothers who was a part of a 300-acre tract that my grandfather paid $3,500 for in 1929, $11.77 if you round it off, an acre's worth.
You'd buy that today, wouldn't you?
About $1.5 million is what it cost me. And the timber's been cut on it twice. It's been properly managed. And here in North Carolina, we have deferment programs, planned use programs for forestry, 20 acres or more generally, and 10 acres of ag or 5 acres of ag, 10 acres of pasture, 5 acres of ag. And they'll do a reduction on the value of the land and then tax on that reduction. So I think we've been paying about $280 a year taxes on that 300 acres over the years. Plus, we've garnished the timber twice and got it going again for the next generation. So it's not a bad investment. So what would
not at all. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's something new we're seeing. And it really changed about the time, you know, when you're reading my bio, and that's kind of the time when I started off with a paper company, Smurfit Stone Container Corporation, which is the old container corporation for anyone listening who think they stretched up into the Carolinas a pretty good bit. And I started managing land for them, but they sold the land. And then I started buying wood on the Atlantic coast of Florida for their paper mill in Fernandina Beach. But there's been a change in land ownership over the years. So all the way up into the 90s, it was very typical to have vertically integrated companies. So, and we still have this. Like, you think of like a Jordan Lumber over Mount Gilead, North Carolina.
Right.
I mean, they own a sawmill. They own timberland, right? So you own a manufacturing facility. You own raw material that can go into that manufacturing facility, and that helps protect you against any fluctuations in prices that might happen on the marketplace. You can just go to your own land and cut, right?
Right.
And so there were a lot of vertically integrated paper companies, Georgia-Pacific,
Westvaco,
International Paper, all these kind of companies that are around. And those companies sold their timberlands off pretty much in the late 90s, early 2000s.
I remember that.
They kept their manufacturing, but they sold the timberlands.
Right.
Those timberlands were, I mean, it was around 45, 50 million acres in total that sold, went into the institutional investment ownership marketplace. And so that was a new player that showed up. And basically what it was, it's just, you think about your, if anyone's a teacher, you think about your teacher's retirement fund, right?
Right.
So teacher retirement funds, they grow up they have these huge balances that they're investing on behalf of these teachers, so that when they retire, they have a pension or a retirement that they get paid after they finish their teaching career. So they're managing large amounts of money at all time, and a lot of these pensions were rolling out parts of their portfolio and buying these forest lands. Well, they weren't just going out and buying them themselves. They were going out and buying them through management organizations. And so we had the birth of these, what they call TIMOs, or timber investment management organizations. So the structure I just explained. And so all of a sudden we ended up with technically a whole lot more forest landowners, but, you know, on paper it's really just one.
Right.
And North Carolina has a lot of institutional investment-owned lands.
We sure do.
Can you think of, Lou, any of those that you might have? That, I know RMS, Resource Management, is in your area.
They are.
I know those guys up there. I know there's some others.
Yeah, I can't think of them right hand. Can you, Teresa?
Yeah, so it was a different ownership model that showed up on the landscape, and these guys are great managers, do a really good job managing land, but they kind of changed the profile of because all of a sudden there's a lot of money available to go buy land, right?
Right.
So I mean, these institutional investment funds, I mean, you get California State Teachers Retirement Fund, I mean, massive fund It also like firemen's protection funds and a lot of these and just wealthy individuals who are looking for another place to put money other than the stock market. Because the great thing about investing in timberland is timber always grows, right?
You got it.
So if
it grows money on trees,
paper markets or wood markets are going up or down, the trees are always going to keep growing.
Yeah. Money growing on trees. Let me take
That's exactly it. That was really the, I guess, the attractiveness of these pension funds moving into owning timberland and investing in this land. But what it did is it really drove land prices up. I mean,
yeah, I did.
We saw because there's readily available capital to invest in these lands and buy these lands. Like I said, they're outstanding managers of these lands. They do a great job. They put a lot of money in the land. But that now land is moving, right? You got a lot of land moving around. And like we said at the beginning of the program, right, most family landowners, they're not moving land around. They're not selling their place or their farm or, you know, their family's holdings. But these institutional investment lands coming on the market, a lot of land, like I said, around 45, 50 million acres of forest land that came on the marketplace. And all of a sudden, it's moving around. And the nice thing for us as individuals is these guys spin off chunks every now and then. And so it gives us the opportunity to go pick up these lands that are, one, well-managed and, you know, available to us. So these guys are always looking to move land around. So, you know, it was an interesting change that happened in late 90s, early 2000s, but one that really changed the landscape for us as far as what land was worth and availability of buyers and availability for us to go in and have lands that were available for purchase. All these lands are out there, and they move around a lot, and they trade hands a lot. So it was an interesting change that happened in the marketplace for these private forest lands, you know, that happened in the past 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I used to get mailers all the time, you know, performance of liquidation, and never got involved in any of it. I don't cater to that type of investor, but I was very aware of it and, you know, and watched it go through the transition. So interesting. I want to go back. What is a typical person? Why does a person, landowner, family owner, give you guys a call? What's a typical reason they call you?
Yeah, most of them are looking for a way to do their part to ensure that their next generation is going to be able to take this land on. So it's an insurance policy to ensure property rights and markets are going to be there for the next generation. I just spoke to a new member that we picked up in Arkansas yesterday, and that's exactly what he said. He said, "Look, you know, this is I'm phasing out of the land ownership, overseeing the operations on the land. I have three daughters that are coming in." He said, "You know, the Forest Landowners Association looks like the organization that's going to ensure my family is going to be able to manage these lands into the future." So, when you think about who is that watchdog or who is that guardian who's going to be there to make sure that nothing else changes. Because here's a good example, Lou, is that you can't control acts of God. You can't control an ice storm in North Carolina from coming and hurting your property or damaging things on your property. But the one thing you can change is you can change the federal government coming in and saying, you no longer can do this operation or you no longer can do X, Y, or Z on your property because we don't think it's in our best interest. Now, those are controllable. And so most people that come to us, they say, we like our freedom of operation, we enjoy our property rights, but what are we doing to ensure that we're going to have those into the future? And that's how people find us. That's how they come to us.
Gotcha. Our guest today is Scott Jones. This is Let's Talk Land.
Scott, this is all very interesting to me. I never even realized that there were issues with land. I'd heard about deforestation and stuff like that, but I never really...
That's always the story, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you hear all the bad stuff, but you don't hear the good stuff. So I was wondering, you know, what successes that you guys have had helping people, and what are things that you're most proud of?
Yeah, thanks, Teresa. We have had one of the biggest successes that I point to over the years, and it impacts everyone who owns land, no matter if you're row cropping or whatever you're growing trees. If you own a piece of land, you're in a unique situation that you're usually land rich and cash poor. If you're one of the very fortunate that doesn't have that imbalance, issue probably doesn't impact you much. But that's where most of us are, is that you have a very large, not very liquid asset that is valued very high. And so when you look at someone's estate when they pass away, the estate tax, or like we like to call it, the death tax, is something that has impacted Americans' ability to maintain land ownership in families over the years. And it's just a devastating tax. You know, it came in around the time of the Revolutionary War. It taxes the estate upon death. It creates massive operational changes on properties that weren't planned. I mean, we've seen landowners who, and I'm going to tell you a story about it because it's such a great story, but the estate tax, the death tax, has been especially punitive on private landowners and farmers across this country for many, many years. And because of that, one of the things that we really hang our hat on is, and what I said at the beginning, is success for us is landowners being able to pass this land down to the next generation, and it'd be economically feasible for them to still continue managing that land. Well, if a landowner is being taxed at a rate of 45% on the estate at the time of a death, devastating as it is when that family member passes away, usually the only way to pay that tax is to sell that property, yep, or go cut all the timber off that property, or sell off all your rights on that property in the form of a conservation easement. And these are never the decisions that the landowner wants to make, but they're decisions they have to make because of a tax that is really out of place, a tax that has seen its time and needs to go away. But over the years, we've been working on this, and you think all the way back to 2000 when we were starting a phase-out period during the Bush administration. We had a 10-year phase-out of the federal estate tax or the death tax. And at that time, estates that are worth $1 million, that includes insurance policies, includes any stocks you may have, includes the value of your land, any estates over $1 million can be taxed at a rate, I think at the time it was like 35%. Unbelievable. I mean, you think of the massive transfer of lands out of families, people that were just devastated. I can share story after story of unintended consequences this tax had, of people having to get rid of lands. But today, that tax, and we're still working on it, but in 2017, when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act passed, that the estate tax is now at $22.5 million for couples. Your estate has to be worth over $22.5 million for you to be taxed under this tax right now. We're very proud of that. It's an interim step towards full repeal of this tax, but what a punitive tax, and a tax that really its time has come to go away, and one that we're going to keep working on. But I'm so proud of the work that we did during that particular piece of legislation that passed in 2017 to really get that ceiling raised on the estate tax, so that, I mean, you think about how many families and how many farms are saved every day across this country because that the limit on that tax was raised so much higher. I mean, it's a big deal. And Teresa, I know I'm going on about this tax, but is it okay if I share with you guys one story about it?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. Go.
Okay, so there's a family out in Corvallis, Oregon. So Corvallis is just south of Portland, Oregon. Beautiful place. You're getting down towards that Willamette Valley. It's where Oregon State University is located. And so I'm out there with this landowner, and it's a fairly sizable landowner. But the one thing that's unique, and just imagine this in your mind, their forest land is kind of like this mountainous forest land. It's Doug fir and spruce and other pines, ponderosa pine. But it's in the view of Oregon State's campus. I mean, most people would say that's a curse, right?
Yeah.
Man, you got a college campus staring at logging jobs and stuff like that. I mean, you just automatically feel like you're going to get protested by somebody. But they're in a unique situation, so and they embrace that situation. And they would do tours out on their property, and they have a standing tour every week that if anyone wants to come see their property, they can come see it. And they're really great stewards of their property, and that's why they give tours. They're proud of what they do. They're not hiding it from anyone, and they're right there to educate people about what they do. So great, great stewards of the land. I was out there visiting with them, and they have this little short tour they do, and at the end they have a memorial rock. So cool idea, right? All the members that have been a part of that land ownership, all the family members that have been a part of that land ownership that have passed on have a plaque on that rock. And so there's plaques, and I'm kind of reading the plaques of the landowner. And I noticed some dates that look kind of funny, and the landowner says, he saw me looking at it puzzled. He said, I see you catching on to what happened. And I said, yeah, what's going on? It looks like, was that your dad and your brother? He said, yeah. He said, we were in a plane crash, and they didn't make it, and I did.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, my gosh, it's horrible. I mean, they were in a small single-engine plane. Plane crashed. His father, his brother passed away. He lives. And then we start touring the property, and he has all these signs up on these clear cuts. And it said, like, you know, clear cut 94, clear cut 94. And not thinking and being the true Southerner I am, I put my foot in my mouth, and I said, wow, y'all really, really whacked this place pretty hard in the 90s. And he's like, yeah, we had to pay the estate tax.
Wow, yeah.
And all this beautiful land and these rolling hills that they're so proud of, right in the view shed of Oregon State, and, you know, doing all these tours. And they were forced to go out there and just slick this place off. I mean, it totally changed that forest forever. To pay a tax because of a tragic accident that they were already suffering through the loss of these family members, and now they're having to go out there and cut all this timber down, totally change their management, totally change what they want to do, just to pay a tax.
Yeah.
It's in that story. I guarantee you, I could tell you three or four more. I won't today, but I mean that story gets played out in a lot of places until we got to where we are today. So. That's something we're going to stay vigilant on. Something I'm very proud that we've accomplished, and we didn't do it alone. There are a lot of other groups out there working on this. Yeah. Every realtor group, every farming group. This is punitive to people who own land. So especially punitive to people who own land. So it's something that I'm proud of where we are today. It's an interim step towards getting this tax fully repealed. And I'll share with you the thing that. A talking point that I've always loved is people say, you know, you can't have taxation unless you have respiration. So don't tax
or preparation.
Don't tax the dead. Okay, so it's something we're going to keep working on and stay vigilant on until we get it right.
Congratulations on that, Teresa.
Well, I think that you know there's going to be things like that happen, but I think as long as people are good stewards of the land, that we can rebound. I did find some information online when I was kind of looking at this before I came in, and it talked about the United States versus some of the other countries is far ahead of keeping our forest healthy. And there's things in place that can keep our forest healthy. And actually, I even found some information. It said that a working forest can even be healthier and more resilient and able to adapt to climate change. So I'm sure there's things that get that good stewards, the people that understand land and know how to work their land, even if they have to take away from it, that they come back and they can do something positive with it, and not just pillage it and, you know, let it die and turn into something horrible. So
you said something really key there, Teresa, and it's something that's very important note to make here is that it's working land.
Right.
These are biological organisms that live on these that we plant on these properties. They aren't there in perpetuity. You know, they're not going to continue, you know, providing us, you know, lumber products and paper products and clean air and clean water forever unless we work those lands, unless we manage those lands. And all of that is rooted in good markets.
Yeah.
So there's no way that we can continue working these properties unless we have strong markets for those properties. I mean, and you think back. This is the number we use. You made a good point also about the health of our forest. We have more forest growing in this country since the 1950s. We're growing more wood. We have more land covered in forest land today than we did in the 1950s. Now, think about what the difference in the population is today versus the 1950s.
Yeah.
That seems counterintuitive, right?
Yeah,
you would
think,
but it bucks the narrative that you have out there in the general public and across our society that obviously we're cutting down all of our forest, and you guys fight this all the time in North Carolina. It seems like we're cutting down all of our forest and that we're growing beyond sustainability, and that, you know, where are we going to put all these people? We have more forest land today in this country than we did 50 years ago.
Right.
And the population has soared since the 50s.
But only 3%.
Yeah, we're growing more wood.
But only 3% of the land use in the United States is urban. Only 3%.
You know, that boggles people's minds. You think you've got to get out of the city. But, you know, it's good to live in the city because, you know, that's good. It eats all this land. But that, Lou, that's a great point. And when you bring that up to people, they go,
really?
What? You know, it just doesn't seem right, right?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. So what do you guys charge? How do you sustain your organization?
Yeah, so our organization is mainly funded through membership. And we charge membership by the number of acres that you own. It's 5 cents an acre.
Okay.
Our charges start at 250 acres. So if you have 250 acres or less, it's $100 a year. We have a bi-monthly publication called Forest Landowner Magazine. Very, very proud of this magazine.
How do they subscribe to that? How do they subscribe?
It's a great publication. Great information. I mean, the last issue, and I'm looking at it right now, the last issue of the magazine that just came out, it's the November-December issue, because it comes out every 6 times a year. It's a bi-monthly publication. The last issue featured a story about the estate tax, where we are on the estate tax, cost and cost trends. So very popular issue of the magazine because we detail what landowners are paying to do certain things on their land, a lot of it like site preparation, reforestation, road building, all these kind of things. So that and we talked about the impact of the China tariffs on the wood products industry. So Forest Landowner Magazine is a great publication. It comes with your membership, and it always has very timely information in there about what's going on with forest land ownership. So real benefit of membership. The easiest way to find out about us is to go, to our website. It's just forestlandowners.com, or you can just type in Forest Landowners Association in Google or whatever search engine you use, and we'll pop right up, and you can navigate around there. And Lou, you've been to our website.
Absolutely.
No website's ever perfect, but I think it tells a pretty good story.
No, you've done a great job.
Pretty easy to navigate around and find some information about us.
Yep, you've done a good job with it. I don't know who your web host is, but no, it's very easy to work and a lot of information there. A lot of information there. What other means of resource to support your organization other than membership?
Yeah, we also have a foundation, and if you don't mind, I'll just tell you quickly about the foundation.
Yeah, please, I want to know.
We have a group called the Forest Landowner Foundation. It is associated with us. I'm the director of the foundation as well. But the foundation was started in 1988. Our original project was a program called the Woodlands Management Course.
Okay.
So it was a correspondence course that landowners could take, and what you would do is you would sign up to take the correspondence course, and we'd send you a couple chapters at a time. You would read through the materials. You would take a short test at the end, and you would mail it to your local extension agent, who would then grade it. And then once you completed the course, you got a certificate of completion. But it's funny, one of the more famous private forest landowners in the South is the keyboardist for the Rolling Stones, Chuck Lavelle.
Yeah, sure.
He has been a member of Forest Landowner Association for a long time.
Okay.
He's been a member here for a long time, but he'll tell you that he learned about, it's his wife, Rose Lane's property, and he'll tell you that he learned about forest land ownership in the back of the tour bus for the Rolling Stones. He was taking the Woodlands Management course. That's what he was doing.
It's crazy.
And so that's how our foundation started. It started as an education and research foundation. We have really branched out to really focus on the next generation of private forest landowners. We offer scholarships. We do one to NC State every single year. Clemson to the south. And we offer 10 scholarships every year to forestry students who have an interest in working with private forest landowners. We also offer a fellowship to graduate level students who are working on issues that are important to private forest land ownership. And we also have a public policy institute where this is all through the foundation, where we will bring students from, last year was University of Florida and Virginia Tech. We'll bring them to D.C. During our winter board meeting. We'll take them around. They can meet administrative officials, members of Congress, and really learn about the impact policy has in the land ownership world. And so those students that have an interest in forest land policy, we try to fan that flame a little bit through our Public Policy Institute and bring those students up there. So those are a few things our foundation does. They're linked onto our website as well, but really proud of the growth of the foundation and what they're doing and where they're going. It's a really neat organization. It's funded through contributions by individuals. And I would encourage anyone who's listening, if I said something about these scholarships or fellowships or this Public Policy Institute, that and we fund research projects also that help inform our advocacy work. If any of those are interest to you, we're always looking for support. We don't have big corporate donors. This is a private forest landowner foundation. We're funded by our members and by landowners. So we don't have big corporate America funding this foundation.
Sure.
I would love to have it, but
yeah, me too. Sounds like my radio show. I need a funder.
Yeah, it's a small but very impactful part of our organization. And one that I think is really essential. If you're serious about the future of forest land ownership, you better invest in it. And that doesn't just mean working on the policy that's out in front of you today. It's investing into the future as well. So that's what that foundation's doing. And it's a really neat group, and they really passionate, dedicated individuals running that organization and doing some really cool stuff as well.
Congratulations. Thank you for sharing that with our listening audience, because just like you said, if you have any interests, your family's got some, there's a lot of people's families that own land and they don't even know what to do with it. And somebody may be listening to this show and learn about you, Scott, and your organization, and maybe even to transition that property for the future. A lot of opportunity here. And thank you for your service and your work you're doing. Teresa, you got something?
Yeah, I was just looking at the information that Lou has got written down here about the Forest Landowner Foundation, and it says that they manage their working forest with a holistic approach. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's really looking at it for all the benefits that are coming from the property. So, the one thing that's unique about our organization, I'm glad you asked this question, because it's a real distinguishing factor, and I think it defines who we are very well, is that when we look at ways to sustain the forest into the future, we're looking at the landowner. When you think back to one of the earlier segments in the show where I was explaining, 58% of all of our forest land in the U.S. is privately owned. And almost all the wood products in this country are coming off those lands. And then you think about what we just talked about, Teresa, about how those lands had to be worked. And so when you think about environmental and economic benefits, those are all coming from private forest lands. So most organizations that are out there that work in the forestry sector or the forest landowner sector, they're always talking about the resource. They're always talking about the trees. Those trees, those resources are afforded by the person who owns that land, and that's the private landowner. And so if you don't sustain that landowner, that land's not going to be sustained that way. It's not going to continue growing trees. And I think that's an assumption that is made incorrectly a lot of times, especially in the policy arena, that as landowners, we're just going to keep doing what we're doing, that, that we're not going to change what we do, that if we're pushed too far, then we'll just accept it. Then we'll just, if all of a sudden our land's not economically feasible to own, well, you're going to keep planting those trees, right? I think that's an assumption that is going to be challenged at some point in time soon. And that's why as an organization, we say, if you want to sustain forest lands, you better sustain the people that own them. because that's a key point. And it's something that gets overlooked. I mean, we're looking at the owner, not the resource. The resource is there because of the owner. The owner has the decision because of private property rights, because of the rights afforded to us in this country to make the decision on how they use those lands. My forefathers used it for cotton fields. I'm growing trees on it.
Yeah, exactly.
What are my kids going to do? I don't know, but they get to make that decision. So if we want those lands to be forest lands, got to focus on the people. And that's what distinguishes our organization over others, is we're focused on the landowner and the person and what's going to sustain them, like an estate tax, like we just talked about.
Right.
The trees aren't going to pay that. They might get cut down to pay it, but the landowner is the one that has to pay that. So it's a very distinguishing point, and one that keeps us focused on the work that we do here, is that we make sure it's going to be focused on that landowner.
What other legislative issues are current?
Yeah, you know, right now, thankfully, not a whole lot.
Kind of calm out there.
We're working on a little bit of cleanup on some tax issues. You know, we had devastating hurricanes across the Gulf. This time last year, October of last year, we had Hurricane Michael. We've had, you know, there was a tremendous amount of forest land that was impacted by Hurricane Michael. But you think back to Hurricane Hugo, you know, in the 90s, and you think back to Katrina in the mid-2000s. I mean, we've had some really bad hurricanes. And the one thing that's unique about these ownerships is that your loss on the forest land is your basis. Well, anyone who thinks about forest or land taxation, you know that on forest land, your basis goes to zero at about 8 years old. So if you have a 25, 30-year-old stand of timber, and it gets blown down by a hurricane or an ice storm in North Carolina, your recovery, your loss, according to the federal tax code, is zero.
That doesn't make sense.
What about the wildfires that are destroying all the land?
You know, that's the same thing, Teresa. I'm glad you asked that, because they're in the same situation. I mean, all forest land that falls under these natural disasters, if the timber's over 8 years old, the basis is zero. So your recovery, your loss, according to the IRS, is zero. And so it's up to you to replant all those lands, to put that back into production, to do something else with it. And what spurred us to do this is we had a landowner who owned 2,000 acres of timberland. Grant, that's a lot of land.
That is.
Owned 2,000 acres of timberland, lost it all to a fire. And this couple was in their 70s. And they had no heirs. This was their last of their money. This was it. This was going to be what kept them through the later parts of their years. And they lost every bit of it. And when we talked to them, they're like, well, what's our recovery? And it's like, it's zero. But you're going to replant, right?
You're right.
Oh, my God.
They're not. And so what's the recourse? What are these landowners supposed to do? So we have a bill in Congress right now called the Forest Recovery Act that will change that, to where landowners can recover fair market value after a catastrophic loss instead of zero.
So with regular crops, you have crop insurance, but you don't have forestry insurance, do you?
No insurance. Now, there's a few insurance products out there for forest lands.
I understand, but very few and far between with a lot of requirements.
I'm just going to tell all your listeners, save your time. Don't go price them out, because you're going to get sticker shock pretty quick.
Yeah. A lot of risk there.
That stinks.
I can smell it.
I mean, for lack of a better word.
What's out there that we're working on now. That's a very important piece of legislation that we're working on right now. We're always working on endangered species issues. We're always working on property rights issues. But right now, there's that tax fix is kind of front and center for us right now, and one that we're trying to get across the finish line.
So our listening audience out there, if this is making your heart go bing, boom, boom, and your blood pressure go up, you need to get in touch with Scott. This is a guy in his organization that's really, you got something going here, buddy. Congratulations.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It's, like I said, I'm proud. I'm proud to do it. It's something that I'm very passionate about. But, you know, you feel like that at the end of the day, if we can be successful in the work that we're doing here at Forest Landowners Association, that a lot of landowners are going to benefit for it. And whether, I mean, we love for them all to be members. I mean, granted, we can't hire our staff and do our work for free. So we need all the support we can get. I know everybody's out there asking, but if you have an interest in private forest lands, this is the organization for you. And and the work we're doing is for you, and we're thinking about your future every day. So, you know, we'd be proud to have your listeners come join us and
Absolutely.
Support us. And
please do
and
that.
We're going to keep working hard.
Scott, with just a few minutes left, what have we left out in this show today?
Yeah, the only thing I would go back and reiterate is that, and we were talking about it just a minute ago, is that markets are very important for the future of these forest lands, and the ability for us to sell these products. And I always heard people say, like, you know, if we all stopped eating tomatoes collectively as a country, would we have any tomato farms left? No. I mean, why would you grow something if there's no market for it? So there's always a market for forest products because we use them in paper products and household products and those things, and we use them in our homes or construction and rebuilding and remodeling. But there's some really exciting new markets coming on out there. Of course, biomass, we're selling. That's a big marketplace in North Carolina. We're selling those pellets over to Europe so they can make electricity with lower carbon products, like other than coal.
Right.
And forestry, trees are very, very friendly to our environment. They store carbon and then can recapture them when we replant trees. So they become carbon neutral in nature. But one product that's really exciting that I'll just mention, and you cut me off, Lou, when we get close to time.
We've got about 4 minutes, and we'll use the last two to close out.
What'd you say? How many minutes?
We got about four, and we'll use the last two to close out.
Okay, great. Well, I'd like everybody to just look up cross-laminated timber. It's a really neat product. And
write that down, Teresa.
So cross-laminated timber is basically, you think about 2x4. So a 2x4 piece of wood, like stack about 5 or 6 of those side-by-side together, spray it with glue, then lay another set the opposite way over the top of it and stick them together. They press them together. So what you get is you get a really, really strong panel. And this strong panel can replace other products like concrete and steel. So as this world thinks about carbon footprints and climate change and things along those lines, and we have a need to build a lot more buildings in this country to keep up with growth, forestry is offering a product that can replace carbon-heavy products like concrete and steel with a very carbon-friendly product like wood, because these panels are structurally very strong, and they also help solve a lot of labor issues because you can put these panels together off-site and bring them to the construction site, stacked on the truck in a way to where as they come off, they can pretty much just be snapped together. And this is not conceptual in nature. You can look up cross-laminated timber online. You'll see that there's a lot of banks being built with them, a lot of hotels being built with them. University of Arkansas is building a dormitory with them, student housing with it right now. There's a large five-story building going up in, I believe it's in Oregon, in Portland, Oregon. And there's a building called a T3 building. So you can put in T3 building in Atlanta, Georgia, right here where I am, right now. That's really exciting. So you think about markets for wood products. Those are what's going to help landowners continue having that incentive, that economic incentive, continue managing these lands, economic incentive for the next generation. New markets like mass timber, cross-laminated timber, very, very exciting.
Scott,
so,
Scott, you've
there's
been
hope out there for the future.
Scott, you've been a terrific guest today. We're going to have you back because you can talk for hours with a lot of good stuff.
Man, it's been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed talking to all of you. It's been a lot of fun.
How do they get in touch with you real quick?
Yeah, the best way to get in touch with us is at forestlandowners.com. And if you want to reach out to me, you can reach out to me directly at sjones@forestlandowners.com.
Perfect. Thank you for joining us today. Let us know how you like the show. If you have any guests or topics you'd like to suggest, we would appreciate them. All of our guests are welcome, and all of our guests may be emailed with your questions or concerns as well. This show's for the public and, most importantly, for real estate agents who do not have a source of land education, free land education. All of our shows are downloaded on letstalkland.net, and then after they're broadcast, and then on Podbeam and Spotify. You can reach me at Lou, L-O-U, at mylandpro.com. My cell phone number is 336-669 1405. Teresa, how do they get in touch with you? Teresa Martin.
Teresa Martin. My phone number is 336-209-2937. My email is teresa.mylandpro@gmail.com.
Rodney?
Yes, they can get to the station here. Go to WKTE1090.com, and also they can download the Simple Radio app and hear us all throughout the whole world.
The whole world. So, Scott, download that app, and you can listen to your show.
That's right.
Yep, and spread it around. We're also we're beach music and oldies, but we only play happy music, right?
That's right. Happy music.
Happy music,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right.
And 5 years in a row?
That's right. 5 years in a row on the East Coast there. Number one beach and oldies radio station.
Wow. And you got a real nice award not too long ago.
Yes, the Reader's Choice Award for 2019 Radio Announcer of the Year.
Well, I understand why.
Yeah, I hear you. You'll get there one day, Lou.
I don't know if I want to do that.
Oh, come on now.
Well, we may let Shouty take over.
Okay.
All right. So stay tuned for Dr. Barbie. He's always got something of interest. Have a great evening.